Are human beings capable of altruism, or are they, as many believe, entirely selfish? Clearly, people sometimes act in ways that benefit others. Why does this happen, and where does such behavior come from? In the new book, Does Altruism Exist? Culture, Genes, and the Welfare of Others, biologist David Sloan Wilson provides new answers to these critical questions about altruism based on the latest developments in evolutionary science. Wilson argues that many established ideas about human altruism, including ideas that underpin social and economic policies, are either wrong or not very relevant. When we view human nature through an evolutionary lens, he says, we come to a new understanding of altruism and its central place in human society. David Sloan Wilson is president of the Evolution Institute and SUNY Distinguished Professor of Biology and Anthropology at Binghamton University. When you look at this issue, let us start with how we define altruism. So, in ultimately, the question that you ask in the book title of Altruism Exist, how does that come out of the definition of altruism?
Right. Well, it's important to define altruism in two ways. One is in terms of action, what you actually do. And so anyone who helps others or their group at the expense of themselves is behaving altruistically. Then there's the matter of how you think and feel about it, which provides another definition of altruism. And the relationship between those two is more complex than you might think. There's actually many ways you might think and feel that cause a given action. But at the end of the day, what we really want is for people to help each other. So it's altruism at the level of action that is the most important. And how you might think or feel about it, I think, is a little bit secondary.
You talk about in the book of whether a person helps others in order to believe that the favor will be returned, or for religious reasons of getting to a better place or getting to heaven, that is different. That motive plays a role here.
Motive does play a role, and there's a good reason to be interested in our motives, because we care not only about how you're going to behave now, but how you're going to behave in the future. So it's not as if motives are unimportant. But one thing I say in the book quite often is, let's say I owe you money and I offer to pay you by a cash or check. You might have a mild preference for one of those methods, but your main concern is to be paid. And so, and this is true in our everyday lives, when we sit down and we want to do something that involves working with other people, we want to know what their commitment is. We want to know if they're there for us and for the cause. But other than that, we don't care and we shouldn't care exactly how they feel about it, as long as they're going to commit to the cause.
And it's also selective. It would be right. I mean, in reading the book, I get the idea that sometimes we look at it as an altruistic person versus an altruistic act.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, the main thing that you need to know is that altruism is a social strategy. It is a way of behaving that produces certain consequences. And that strategy can either succeed or fail in competition with more selfish strategies in various forms of Darwinian competition. And that's not just genetic competition. Cultural evolution and even our choice of behaviors on a moment-by-moment basis is going to have consequences. And altruism as a social strategy can win the Darwinian contest, but only when special conditions are met. And so the key to evolving altruism is to provide the right conditions that allow altruism to win the Darwinian contest.
You are president of the Evolution Institute and SUNY Distinguished Professor of Biology and Anthropology at Binghamton University. So we talk to you as an evolutionary biologist, not as a psychologist. So where does the biology come in, much just to pick up where you just left off, the biology role here of looking at what motivates us?
Right. Well, biology enters in all kinds of places. It enters into our psychology. I'm not a psychologist. I didn't get my degree in psychology, but I actually am a psychologist because I study how our minds came to be as they are. And that's not just due to a genetic process. It's due to our cultural process. Your mind is not just based on your genes. It's based on all kinds of cultural and developmental influences. So biology enters into the study of our minds, but it also enters into the study of our social environments, so that, as I said before, if you're in certain situations, you should not be altruistic, because if you do, you will suffer and you won't benefit anyone else but your more selfish competitors. We should not counsel people to be altruistic unless we can provide the social environments where altruism can basically thrive. And we know how to do that. So this has practical implications. This is not just an academic study. We can actually use this information to make the world a better place.
You mention in the introduction of the book that some of the biggest controversies in science end up appearing obvious in retrospect, even though decades were required for their resolution. And you believe when it comes to altruism, we are in that resolution phase. So how so, and what has the disagreement been about?
Yeah, that's a great great question. So here's the solution and what the disagreement is about. Here's what's so simple in retrospect. Social life involves cooperation. It involves people doing things for each other. And those traits are vulnerable to exploitation by more selfish traits. So basically, altruism and cooperation is vulnerable to selfishness in any social grouping. So how can altruism evolve? Well, groups of altruists are superior to groups that are handicapped and crippled by selfishness. So natural selection at the group level can favor altruistic groups over selfish groups, even though altruistic individuals are vulnerable to selfish individuals within groups. That's it in a nutshell. Selfishness beats altruism within groups. Altruistic groups beat selfish groups. That's it. What's all the fuss about? But it turns out that this idea that everything is selfish and that everything evolves must be selfish had its day in biology in the same way that it currently has its day in economics and business. We think that, you know, it might be nice to be altruistic at home and in your family and stuff like that, but when it comes to our economy or the hardball world of business, then altruism has no place. It turns out that's just flat out false.
We were talking a moment ago about altruism as a biological topic, a topic in biology. You have a chapter in the book dedicated to psychological altruism. So how do you define that separately from how we look at this in an evolutionary biological function?
Well, everything that evolves has to have two explanations. First, why did it evolve compared to many other things that could have evolved? And that tends to be a functional explanation. A bird is shaped the way it is because that's what allows it to fly through the air. The second explanation is how does it exist in a more mechanistic physical sense? What are bird feathers made of and so on? And so with altruism, we need to know, you know, how does that trait survive in a Darwinian world? How can we make it so that an altruistic trait exist compared to more selfish traits that could have existed? But then we have to ask that second question: what actually causes the individual to be altruistic? Does he do it because it feels good, because he thinks it's the right thing? Or then there's other mechanisms which don't count as altruistic in most people's minds. Do you do it because you want to have a good reputation? Is somebody paying you to do it? So basically, there's many ways to skin a cat. And there's many ways to motivate altruism, and we shouldn't be too picky about them. I think one of the problems in the way that altruism has been studied is that we think that you have to think a certain way in order to count as altruistic, and if you think some other way, then that's somehow not as good, even though it causes you to behave in an altruistic fashion. And so I think we need to be more accepting and more pluralistic, basically, in all of the different ways that can motivate people to be altruistic and to do good things for each other.
How important is self-identification in this? Because I think most of us, if you ask us, we want to be good people, and we would have altruism as part of that.
That's exactly right, although it's also important to appreciate individual differences. That's the kind of research I do in Binghamton and which has such practical applications. If you ask people, how interested are you in helping others, you get a lot of variation. You get everything from, you know, real sweeties that you could trust your life to, all the way to people that you wouldn't trust with anything. And then if you see how those individual differences play themselves out in everyday life, you see that, you know, for the most part, what people say is true. Those who actually express an interest in helping others, they do, and it's very important. They are very important for the quality of our lives, our neighborhoods, our families, and so on. But for those who say no, often that's because, not because they're evil people or they were born with selfish genes, it's because they're in a situation where it's basically would be unwise for them to be altruistic. If they did, then basically they would be exploited. And if you can provide the opportunities, then where it's basically safe to be an altruist, then most people, not all, but most people will open up and they will become more altruistic for the simple reason that it's safe to be so. So we're basically like snails that are capable of pulling in and out of our shells, but we only come out of our shells in a safe environment. And that's what a giving attitude is like. It's vulnerable, and so we only do it when we feel safe about it.
I find this to be fascinating because you note in the book that when we demand altruistic behavior in environments that don't support altruism, that the results can be quite disastrous.
That's right. There's a whole chapter called Pathological Altruism, and it's an indication of why we do need to change the way we think about altruism. Everyone acknowledges that selfishness comes in good and bad forms. We call it the good form, enlightened self-interest. But when it comes to altruism, we tend to think that only good can come of it. We should always encourage each other to be altruistic. But an evolutionary view makes it very clear, obvious in retrospect, that altruism can also come in good and bad forms. And so we really have to be more smart, basically, about counseling altruism in the right way. Otherwise, there will be pathological consequences of altruism.
So you end the book, and without giving away the ending, you talk about planetary altruism, which is basically you answer the question of the title, does altruism exist? And to you, it does if we define altruism this specific way.
Right, and the thing about altruism is that everything that we associate with altruism turns into selfishness up the scale. So what's good for me can be bad for my family. What's good for my family can be bad for my clan. What's good for my clan can be bad for my nation, and so on, all the way up to what's good for my nation can be bad for the global village. And so what this means is that when it comes to the policies and the behaviors and the practices that we select, it's not good enough to confine your attention to these lower units. That's going to create problems higher up the scale. And so if we want the world to be a better place at the planetary scale, which we must when you look at the matters such as the environment and the climate and the worldwide economy, then you have to plan with the highest scale in mind, just attending to you, basically feathering your own nest at various levels, is going to be part of the problem. And so at the end of the day, not only does altruism exist at these various scales, but for it to actually lead to the best outcomes, we can't just be altruists, we have to be planetary altruists. And that follows at a fairly elementary level from an evolutionary perspective. Unlikely to be wrong.
And just to point out that when you talk about altruism, we aren't just talking about individual altruism either. You say that basically that same rubric can be used for corporations or nations of how we define an altruistic act.
Correct. And one of the great discoveries in evolutionary biology is the fact that organisms like you and I are actually highly regulated social groups. That we are the groups of past ages. We're actually groups of groups of groups. And so the whole concept of organism and society have merged. And the task is to turn society basically into a organism, a superorganism if you want, which also has destructive potential because superorganisms, of course, when they fight each other, then they can have even more severe consequences than smaller organisms. But there's no escaping the fact that we need society to work so well that it qualifies as an organism, and to some extent it does. It's amazing, really, how well our societies work at the scale that they do. 20,000 years ago, all groups were small groups, and today we live in groups of many millions and even billions of people that are, you know, fairly cooperative and well coordinated. But we need to do better.
You mentioned a moment ago in our discussion about how we are in a resolution phase, that we've reached this point of a lot of conversation and scientific bickering over something, and that you know, we look back, or will look back, and say, you know, why was this so hard to figure this out? With that in mind, I ask the question, so will we ever change in the sense of, is the evolution complete, or will we evolve that we could become more or less altruistic?
Well, evolution is never complete, and it's so important to emphasize that there's more to evolution than genetic evolution. Almost everybody thinks about evolution as if it's just a matter of genes, and that's true for the biologists in addition to the lay public. But as soon as you think of evolution as taking place in our development as individuals, in our choice of behaviors, and in our cultures, then evolution is all around us. And because the environment is always changing, then we have to evolve to keep up with it. And we need to manage the evolutionary process, because if we don't, then evolution, unmanaged, will definitely take us where we don't want to go. Evolution does not make everything good. It's only in very special conditions that evolution leads to outcomes that are for the good of everyone. So this means that everyone has to become smart about evolution in a way that's so practical that almost nobody appreciates how much we need evolution in a practical sense. That's what's so sad about the debates that do take place. The creationists, the half the people that don't believe in evolution, oh, it is so sad when you think about what an important tool evolution provides for improving the human condition.
So when it comes to the human condition, given your work, given your research, can we be fairly pleased with how we act as a culture and a society when it comes to how we treat others?
Well, there's always good news and bad news, isn't there? And I think it's definitely that glass that's half full. But I think we should concentrate on the empty part, especially in America, because we've swung away from altruism, and we've swung towards a culture that is very non-altruistic and also just flat out doesn't work well. So we need to think hard about the way our country used to be, which was more altruistic, and the way it needs to be in order to solve some of our social problems. And, you know, so much depends on the stories that we tell each other. And the stories that we've been, the narratives, basically, that have been dominant over the last half century, which place such an emphasis on individual interest, as if everything is a matter of the, you know, the brave unregulated individual, government is bad, socialism is evil. Now, these are such stupid stories that we need to have better stories, and those stories have to be underpinned by science. And I think that is what is available, and many more people need to know about it, which is why, as you can see, I was passionate about writing the book and talking about it.
And it just seems that, and perhaps I'm oversimplifying this, but given your use of the word narrative here, that if we have a narrative, or if we have an example of a quote unquote altruistic act, that, again, going back to an earlier point, that makes us feel better, then why do we not, as a culture and individually, tend to swing more that way and have that backed by the science?
Well, it goes back to what we've been talking about, the idea that ideas and stories can succeed by causing everyone to do well, or they can succeed by causing some people to do well at the expense of others. And so the narrative that greed is good, basically, that by pursuing our self-interest, often conceptualized just in terms of wealth, that not only will this be good for the individuals, but also will be good for society as a whole. This is the story that Ayn Rand made so powerful, among others, that I can just concentrate on getting what I want, and that's morally pure, basically. If only all of us could do this, then the society would be a better place. That's very appealing psychologically. You know, people can really get sucked into that. And yet at the same time, when everyone pursues it, some people benefit, you know, the 1% benefits, but that the society starts to fail. So it's not hard to understand why people would believe it for its psychological appeal, and why some people would believe it because it actually does cause them to be successful. But as a prescription for society, it's a cancer is what it is.
David Sloan Wilson is author of the new book, Does Altruism Exist? Culture, Genes, and the Welfare of Others. He is president of the Evolution Institute and SUNY Distinguished Professor of Biology and Anthropology at Binghamton University. David, thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book is Does Altruism Exist? It is published by Yale University Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.